KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operation and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communication Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Policy and Governance Committee meets on the third Tuesday of March, June, September, and December at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if the meeting is being held.
Support for KBOO comes from its members and from 988 Oregon, a public service providing help from trained counselors for when stress, worry, and sadness strike. Help is available by calling or texting 988. More info at 988oregon.org.
Welcome to American Indian and Alaskan Native Living, a program designed to educate and inspire listeners throughout Indian country. American Indian and Alaskan Native Living is hosted by Dr. David DeRose, a board-certified specialist in both internal medicine and preventive medicine. Dr. DeRose has a wide range of experience with Native health issues, and he is here today to help you learn more about your health. Here is Dr. DeRose.
Welcome to American Indian and Alaska Native Living. I'm Dr. David DeRose. We've got a really great show lined up for you today. I've got an amazing guest who's been helping people navigate through the challenges that come with trauma. So whether you're a First Nations person who's still struggling with aspects of historical trauma, if that is something that you really resonate with, whether you've gone through difficulties in your own home life, regardless of whether you're from an indigenous background or any other background, whether you're dealing with trauma, difficult situations right now, we've got a lot of practical help. And by the way, just full disclosure, all of us deal with traumatic events. This is not just a Native topic. David Jones is my guest. He's a licensed marriage and family therapist. He's an adjunct professor at Weimar University. David, it's great to have you with us on today's show.
Thank you for having me.
David, you gave a fascinating presentation at a professional meeting not all that long ago called Overcoming Generational Trauma. And we really want to dive into that because it seems so relevant to so much of what many of us deal with today. But before we do that, you've got a story. I mean, people just don't go into this field unless they have some personal interest in it. Tell us a little bit about who you are.
Yeah, so mental health was not exactly what I thought I would get into. I've always had a liking for art. I thought I was going to be a comic book artist actually when I was younger. But at some point, it caught my interest, partly because I had someone tell me, you're not going to make money as an artist, and so that you probably should find something else. But I took one of those little questionnaires that talk about what careers you might be good at, and a therapist came up on that. And when I first saw it, I was like, oh, there's no way I'd do that. But as I started to study psychology more and more, I fell in love with it. I definitely dealt with seeing mental health issues around me and my own family, and seeing how those things impacted my mom and impacted other people in my household. It really became apparent to me that this is a real need. And it also turned out because I usually was that kind of friend that everybody would ask advice from, and sometimes I'd find myself counseling with adults, that maybe this is something that I might be kind of called into doing. And so this is largely what led me into the mental health field.
That's fascinating. So you kind of had this sense that the Creator maybe had basically called you into this discipline even when you were quite young.
Yes, yeah. Looking back and reviewing some of these conversations and looking at how my life went, it's like it was very much leading there, even if I thought I was supposed to do something different, like draw for, be a comic book artist. So like, yeah, there was other plans for me. I don't regret any of them. It's definitely been the spot where I believe I need to be.
So comic book artists could change the world. I'm sure some people who are in that industry feel sure. That way, but definitely you've been working a lot closer one-on-one with folks. You can relate to challenges that people of color faced and are facing right now. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about that. Did you feel like growing up, you had to deal with prejudice in your own life?
Oh, absolutely. I grew up in a small town in California, and I recall I actually got held back in what grade it was in. It was probably like the first or second grade, which that's an odd grade to hold somebody back. I was able to read, write, I knew math, and there was really no reason to hold me back other than just the fact that I was a Black student there. I remember getting bullied and getting into a fight where the entire school was watching, including the teachers, did absolutely nothing about it. I mean, like, so all those things that that can happen, I experienced some of them. I mean, certainly wouldn't compare my experiences to people who lived a little bit further back into history, but you know, the early mid-80s was still not exactly a time of racial tolerance, especially in really small communities. So.
Okay, so you've got this diverse background. You grew up in an environment that had its challenges. You saw this talent for mental health. You end up going into it. Now you're teaching other people. And like I said, I was very impressed with your presentation on generational trauma and how we can overcome that. Let's talk a little bit about that whole area. Why even talk about so-called generational trauma?
Yeah, well, there's a book title that really arrested my attention, and it was It Didn't Start With You. And the title really explains a lot. Like, there's a lot of things that sometimes we can be carrying in our lives and trying to figure out, like, why do I feel the way that I do? Why do I get upset and triggered by some of the things that bother me and upset me? And a lot of times it's because you're not the first person to deal with it. Someone else has dealt with this. And I know, again, for myself, my own experiences taught me that I was always wondering, like, why was I really afraid to, like, be more ambitious? And, you know, one day I was talking with my dad, and I listened to his narrative about why he also struggled with ambitions. And it sounded just like mine. Even without me knowing his story, I was just living out a very similar story to his without just completely unconscious of the fact that a lot of times we end up facing the very same challenges. And some cultures would look at this as kind of like fighting the same demons that your parents fought. And there's a blessing side to this too. Like, sometimes you inherit some of the good traits. Like, my dad's very intellectual, thinks very philosophically, and definitely handed that down to me. But sometimes we also get the other part of the story where there's these challenges and this part of the script that maybe was unfinished for him and that I sometimes have to carry. And so if we look at generations as a story that unfolds where our lives are in a chain of lives and events, then it becomes clear that we're going to be picking up from someone else's story. While we can still write our own, we're still going to have to take what we've inherited and then make sense out of that to begin to narrate our own story. And then the story passed down to our children will also be important. So anyway, so I see the generational trauma as like this continuous story that we hand, that are handed to us and that we hand down to the next generation. And the more we can understand about the stories that we've inherited, the better we can start to navigate how we rewrite our own stories to make sure it doesn't just go in the same bad direction, or use the good parts to lead us into a place that's positive.
So let's just talk about this a little bit more, because it's fascinating, and especially in light of what you presented at Weimar University for a series of public meetings. And you shared some psychology research talking about how these stories, if you will, there's evidence even in animal models that are not just something that we've heard and that we grow up with, but there's actually the ability to turn genes on and off. This is something that I don't think is just intuitive. People don't just say, oh, well, this is obvious. Tell us a little bit about this, some of the research that's gone into letting us know that we're really shaped by the previous generations.
Yeah. So this is a term that I'm not sure if everybody's familiar with, but it's called epigenetics. So your genes, your genetics, you can think about this as like the basic code that tells you how your body's supposed to be formed, how your brain's supposed to be formed, et cetera. And then there's this epi part. And epi is just like the thing that operates above. And so if you think about the genetics as the book, if you will, then the epigenetics, the epi part of it is how that book is read. And that part also gets passed down. So one of the animal studies that we talked about in the presentation was with these mice. And what they did with these mice is they exposed them to like an electric shock, and they paired it with the smell of cherry blossom. And so whenever they would spray the cherry blossom, they'd get a little zap, and which is not very friendly. But anyway, this is how we try to learn things. And so so they'd zap the mice with the smell of the cherry blossom. And eventually, based on just some basic classical conditioning, the mice would become afraid of the smell of the cherry blossom. Now, that was interesting, but that was stuff that we already knew. So then they wanted to see what happens when these mice have pups. Hmm. So when the pups were born, the pups would then be exposed to the smell of the cherry blossom. They were not exposed to the electric shock. But even though they'd never been shocked before, when they smelled the cherry blossom, they immediately had a fight-flight response to it. They immediately became terrified. They would run away. They would actually experience a fear response, even though they had never been shocked with it before. It was as though they inherited their parents' fear of that smell. And what they found is that it can go down to the third and fourth generation, which, you know, for some people who are familiar with other texts, you recognize that term third and fourth generation has some pretty significant implications to it. And so it does get passed down.
Now, this is fascinating because some folks might say, well, maybe they weren't careful. Maybe the mouse, the mother was pregnant with the pups, and that's why it was transmitted. But what you're saying is you're talking about multi-generational. Something has to be transmitted. And do we know that it's genes being turned on and off, or are we just speculating?
Yeah. So the reason that we know that it's genes being turned on and off is because the stress response can be recorded. And because these are mice, they can actually isolate them and make sure they know all the experiences that these mice have had. So they know the pups have never been exposed to any of these electrical shock experiments. I mean, this is part of the reason for doing laboratory experiments, is so that you can control all these other variables and make sure that you're isolating the one variable that you really want to be able to see. Yeah. And in this case, yeah, these third and fourth generations, they had no exposure to the electrical shock. All they had was the genes that were switched on that said, hey, the smell is bad and you ought to run when you smell it. And you could think about why this is adaptive, though, because sometimes you can't teach, especially in the wild, animals don't have time to teach, like, you know, be afraid of this thing. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you have to learn in real time, like deer learning to be afraid of cars, for example. That'd be nice if more of them got out of the way. I'm sure everybody would be glad if they all learned that fear response a little bit quicker. But that is something that can get passed down. But it's not a story that a deer can tell another deer. But it is something that they can instinctively start to build some instructions around. And so this is actually an extremely adaptive response. And it seems to me to point to really strongly to some design features to make sure that the next generation is prepared to deal with what the previous one did. So we want our kids to come in this world being prepared to take on the challenges that we faced. And so it's a good adaptive response, but it can also create problems, like with the cherry blossom, because that's usually not something that mice need to be afraid of. And so it can get out of control too.
So talk with us a little bit. So we've got this animal research that's saying this is something we know in animal models can be transmitted. Fear responses to certain stimuli, if you will. Does this operate in humans as well? Do we know that?
Yes, absolutely. I'll give you maybe just two studies. I'll start with the first one here. This is one that even I think everybody can just grasp intuitively. So when a mother is pregnant with a daughter, there's a certain point where the daughter is going to have all the eggs she's ever going to have. And if the mother is experiencing like stress, then that is going to have a direct impact on the development of the fetus. Now, you can actually see this happening in real time, because those hormones, when they're released, they actually affect how the brain starts to build itself. So let's just say that there's like stress hormones like glucocorticoids and like adrenaline and cortisol, like some of those typical ones that we hear about all the time. Then it's going to tell the brain, like, hey, you're about to come into a really stressful environment where the first thing we need to prioritize is we need to make sure your brain is built for survival and not so much for social connection. And if the mother is pregnant while she's experiencing that stress, it will directly affect the development of the fetus, or the unborn child. Then if that daughter, once she's developed all the eggs she's ever going to develop, this happens while she's still in her mother, those stress hormones would get passed down to those eggs that are inside of her, which means that you actually have three generations minimally represented there, potentially four if one of those eggs becomes a daughter. And anyway, so I mean, like it will happen with the son too, but like you can actually get all of these generations represented like in real time just during pregnancy. But beyond this, they specifically looked at how the emotional state of the mother in particular affects the development of the child. And you can actually see how this affects how the brain. So like children who were born to parents who had been through the Holocaust, for example, they found that they were born with lower cortisol levels. Now, we always think about cortisol as being just maybe a bad thing that's associated with stress, but actually has a regulatory function. Part of the reason for the cortisol is to help re-regulate the person back down to baseline. Mm. And so if you don't have enough cortisol, then what will happen is you'll stay in a stress state longer. Mm. And that is actually the basis of what makes up for trauma. Like people don't develop PTSD just because they've been through something. People develop PTSD because after they went through something, they couldn't come back down from it.
Hmm.
So it's kind of like they stay above that that window of tolerance, and they kind of just get stuck up there. So if you think about a scale from 1 to 10, where 1 is where I feel totally calm and 10 is I'm completely dysregulated, almost to the point of passing out, then we can get stuck.
Well, this is fascinating stuff. And I know we've been talking a lot about theory, but we want to go ultimately to some very practical things that can help each of you who's tuning in today. I'm Dr. David DeRose. The show is called American Indian and Alaska Native Living. My guest today, David Jones, he's a licensed marriage and family therapist, master's degree trained, working on his doctorate. He's also a professor, an adjunct professor at Weimar University. Got a lot more great insights. You don't want to miss them. I'm staying by. I encourage you to do the same. We'll be back right after this.
Today's broadcast has been pre-recorded. However, if you have questions about today's show or would like further information, please reach out to us on the web at aianl.org. That stands for American Indian Alaska Native Living. Again, aianl.org. Or you can call us at 1-800-775-HOPE. That's 1-800-775-4673. We'll be right back after this.
We are strong, we are resilient, and we will get through this together. But these are stressful times, and it's important to also practice good self-care. It's normal to feel overwhelmed, anxious, or afraid, but there is hope. Reach out to someone, connect with your friends, stay in touch with your community, and know that you are not alone. Learn more at wearebroadcasters.com/hope. Furnished by the National Association of Broadcasters and this station.
When Jim died, I wondered if I would be able to keep the farm. Then I heard about the USDA's loan program for socially disadvantaged farmers and ranchers. It's for women and minorities who may be having trouble getting credit. Once I was approved, the USDA's Farm Service Agency helped me get the credit I needed. Now I don't have to sell, and I can pass the farm down to my kids the way Jim's dad passed it down to him. I know he'd like that.
Contact your local USDA service center or visit www.fsa.usda.gov.
Social Security is with you through life's journey from birth to retirement. As your life changes year to year, so do your needs. For over 80 years, Social Security has helped to meet your needs and is committed to improving access to the services that make a difference in your life. Today, you can verify your earnings, estimate your future benefits, apply for retirement, manage your benefits, and even change your address, all from the comfort of your home. Social Security's online services help put you in control with secure access to your information anytime, anywhere, allowing you to spend more time with family, friends, or simply just enjoying the day. Social Security, securing today and tomorrow. See what you can do online at socialsecurity.gov.
Produced at U.S. taxpayer expense.
Thank you.
You're listening to Dr. David DeRose on American Indian and Alaska Native Living. Your comments and questions are welcome. Call now at 1-800-775-HOPE. That's 1-800-775-4673. Here again is Dr. DeRose.
Welcome back to American Indian and Alaska Native Living. I'm Dr. David DeRose. My guest today, David Jones. He's an adjunct professor at Weimar University in Northern California, and he's talking with us about this very important topic of generational trauma, talking about how things can be carried down in our history. Those of you in Indian country, no doubt, are very familiar with discussions throughout indigenous population groups speaking about historical trauma. Some people have tried to minimize that, but clearly, as we're looking at the science, this is a real thing and can have dramatic effects on all of us. So, David, as you've been sharing with us, you've been talking about some of the background, how a mother could be stressed during pregnancy, how that could impact her child. And you use the example of a girl having the next generation in her developing womb, if you will. It's not really the womb, but in the ovaries. Yeah, so we've got this multi-generational effects. A lot of folks, as they're listening, they're saying, well, yeah, I'm glad I'm not a girl. I mean, this is women's stuff. I'm a guy. It doesn't apply to me. Is it safe to say that guys are pretty much shielded from this?
No, that would be a very unsafe conclusion to come to. So while men are not born with all the sperm that they're ever going to develop, each time the body naturally goes through the cycle of developing sperm, it's affected by the mental and physiological state of the male. And so everything from nutrition to stress levels is going to impact how even those gametes are developed, how those sperm cells are developed. And so when they found, again, that men had these kind of stressors, you can actually see how this impacted the development of the child. But maybe some tangible examples that could be helpful here are just maybe even some case studies, because the way that this shows up is so intricate, it'd almost be unbelievable unless people actually, actually heard them talk about it. So one famous example, well, not famous, it is maybe amongst therapists, was a woman who had this. She was really depressed, very severely depressed, and really wanted to die, but very specific about how she wanted to do it. She said she wanted to be like incinerated. Like she's like, I know my brother works. He works with like molten metal and all that stuff, and that's what I want to do. I mean, just like a really unusual. You know, I hear people sometimes having self harm thoughts, but that's really an intense one. Mm-hmm. And so the therapist that was working with her kind of asked us, like, you know, that sounds like a really intense thing. It's like, well, I feel like I don't deserve to be here. And I don't know if it was a point of desperation. Like sometimes some of our best interventions come almost by accident. But he asked her, like, do you have any relatives that were in the Holocaust? She's like, oh, no, I don't think so. And then she paused. She thought, like, actually, no, that's actually not true, because my grandmother was actually survived that. And when my mom had come over, she found out later that her entire family had been incinerated, and she was the one that kind of got away, but she didn't feel like she should have survived. And then, you know, here she is using almost the exact same narrative with no consciousness of why she's using that same narrative and why she's provoked by that same story. And in my own clinical practice, I remember talking with a young person who was probably about like in their early 20s, but they had kind of gotten away from home, and they had almost gotten pregnant, but then, you know, the pregnancy did not actually happen. And they just talked about how tense their relationship was with their mother. And I just kind of asked them, I said, well, how old were you when you left home? I was 17. All right, how did your mom get along with her mom? Not so much. They fight all the time, kind of like we do. Mm-hmm. And I asked, well, how old was your mom when she left? He's like 17. And how old was your grandma when she left? It's like, well, I mean, she kind of got married early, but I think she got married around 17. It's like, that's interesting that everybody seems to keep ending up in the same. And like, you could see the light bulb go off for her, because she realized she was running the same narrative, even down to the things that they were conflicted about. And so, of course, part of our work was seeing if we can break the cycle. So these are some of the ways that this will kind of come out in the office. Most people aren't doing genetic tests to find out whether or not they've inherited trauma from their parents. But man, you can hear it in the stories that we tell.
I think what's fascinating to those of us who are professionals, I mean, you can look at the, you know, the research like you shared, you can show that there is obviously something that's, you know, transmitted. You know, you use that initial example of folks who are just joining us about mice who were traumatized in connection with smelling something that we would probably identify as pleasant in the case of cherry blossoms, and end up associating that with something that's harmful because it was paired with such a traumatic event. And then the future generations also have that same connection. We would say, well, there's obviously no way a mouse told, you know, the future generations, like, this is a bad smell. So, but when it comes to human beings, you know, a lot of people are saying, well, maybe somehow there's some kind of subtle messaging, but you're suggesting, David, that it might be more deeply ingrained than anything that was ever communicated. Does that kind of encapsulate where you're coming from?
Yes. In fact, you know, once we step outside of just the genetic markers, which, like I said, do exist, the way that we usually experience these things, like, let's just use the cherry blossom. We're going to try to get into the mind of a mouse. That mouse doesn't know why it's afraid, but they'll just get like this impression that something about this just ain't right. And they don't really know what the story is behind it, but they feel it very strongly. And I've watched this happen in my own practice. As I'm talking with people, these kind of generationally inherited things, they just feel intuitive. It's just like, it almost feels like this is what I'm supposed to do at this point. This is the part where now I say this to you. And it's so odd because it's not coming in words. It's just really coming in this intuitive perception that this is how I'm supposed to, this is how I take my next step.
So some of these next steps, though, often are, we would say, destructive to the person and to their relationships, right?
Right. They're destructive, but they're familiar. What I found is that people don't make the decisions based on what's like what's best for them, but a lot of times people make decisions based on what's familiar. And sometimes we'll choose familiar even when familiar is bad. That's why people go back into toxic relationships. You know, there was a situation where there's this huge standoff where this there was a domestic violence situation, and this guy was essentially holding this woman hostage, and like at some point she like actually walked out there and she talked with the police officers and all that stuff, and then she walked back in. And afterwards they eventually were able to get the guy to tone down, and they arrested him. And they asked her, like, why did you go back inside? He's like, well, I understood what to do with him, but I didn't know what to do with you all. I didn't know how to deal with this, but I knew how to deal with him. I know his personality. I know how he acts and all sort of stuff, but I did not know how to interact with you all. Everything that you all were explaining to me just felt foreign. It didn't really fit with what I understand about the world. And so she actually went back in where she's being held hostage because that world made more sense. And so people gravitate towards what's familiar more than what's necessarily good or healthy.
So do you feel we're at a point to start talking with folks on the air right now about what they can do to rewrite these narratives, to kind of change these stories and change their responses?
100%. The biggest piece, like, honestly, and it's probably the same thing that they say in AA, like, at some point, you just have to be able to acknowledge when a problem exists. Like, the first step here is just recognizing that something about this ain't working, you know? So if I was a mouse and I was like, man, I'm constantly running away from cherry blossom, but that's right where the food is, and then nothing bad ever happens. Whole trying to avoid cherry blossom when I really could be enjoying something good in my life, and I keep allowing this impression that I have to skirt me away from it. So the first step is actually just gaining some awareness. Once you gain the awareness, once you become conscious of what's going on, and that is a huge first step. The same thing with that woman who wanted to incinerate herself. As soon as she realized that this story wasn't just hers, she was like, oh, wait a minute. This isn't my fate. This is a story that now I have in my hands and I can decide what happens next. And so awareness is first. And the second part is empowerment. And that's the knowledge that I can actually do something about this. Like, this story is not pre-written for me. Like, the words and some of the things that are involved there, maybe I inherit those, but I actually get to determine where the story goes next. I can't change my past, and I can't change the past of my ancestors or the people before me, but I can decide what gets written on these next few pages. So the awareness first, so that we're becoming conscious of what's driving us. And the second one is the empowerment of knowing that we can begin to start writing a new story.
So tell us some stories about people who rewrote their stories.
Yeah, that's a great question. I have a lot that come to mind. I'm trying to think of the one that I can say concisely. So I have like a car accident of like 18 stories all come into my brain at once, and I can't tell them all. Okay. So I always have to change names and faces. So
of course.
For this one, this particular individual had received a narrative that they would, you know, just be fated to live out the same kind of life that their mother did. This person's mom was extraordinarily abusive. I don't know what all of her history was, but it was almost like she grew to like hate her own child and expose her to just a lot of things that I won't traumatize all your listeners by detailing her story, but it was really intense. And so because of these traumas and because of the abuses that she went through, and because her mom was not just really abusive but also really negligent of her, she carried this narrative that she was worthless and that she was always going to be alone in the world. You know, she had detailed the story of like being kind of her mom taking her to this really busy fair and then just walking away and leaving her there on purpose just to, you know, let her suffer from it. It was really tough. And so as we begin to talk through this, a couple of the steps that we took were, one was gaining awareness of how that story is impacting her, how she may be carrying herself as though she's always going to be alone.
So you got us right on the edges of our seat, David, but we definitely want to hear the rest of it, but we do have to step away just briefly. So we're talking about generational trauma. We're talking about how we can overcome it, how we can change our stories. My guest, David Jones, adjunct professor at Weimar University, licensed marriage and family therapist. Practical stuff, very practical stuff coming up that can help you rewrite your own history. That's coming up in our next segment. I'm Dr. DeRose. We'll be back right after these important messages.
American Indian and Alaska Native Living will continue in a moment. If you have questions or comments about today's pre-recorded broadcast, please contact us on the web at aianl.org or call 1-800-775-HOPE. That's 1-800-775-4673.
A message from the National Police Association. It used to be that any able-bodied person would offer to assist a police officer in danger. Now, passersby are more likely to take a video. There's a better use for your phone when an officer's in trouble. Call 911. Tell the operator where you are and what you see. Then, start your video to provide evidence later. To learn more about how you can assist law enforcement, visit nationalpolice.org. That's nationalpolice.org.
Unlike other health concerns, mental illness is not always easy to see. Depression won't show up on an eye chart, and you can't measure it on your bathroom scale. Sorting out a mental health concern is not something to attempt on your own. You won't find a bipolar disorder by looking at a thermometer. Like many other health conditions, help for mental illness takes professional diagnosis and treatment. Anxiety won't just go away under a stick-on bandage. So the sooner you seek treatment, the better. If you or a loved one has a mental health concern, don't go it alone. Find out what to do. For 24-hour free and confidential information and treatment referral, call 1-800-662-HELP. Learn more at samhsa.gov/support. That's samhsa.gov/support.
Using meth taught me everything about freedom, only not like you think. It taught me how easy it is to lose your freedom. If you think meth is taking control of you, ask for help. You have the power to be truly free. I know. I'm Jan, and I'm free from meth.
If you or someone you know is struggling with meth, call 1-800-662-HELP for 24-hour free and confidential treatment referral. Learn more at samhsa.gov/meth.
You're listening to Dr. David DeRose on American Indian and Alaska Native Living. Your comments and questions are welcome. Call now at 1-800-775-HOPE. That's 1-800-775-4673. Here again is Dr. DeRose.
Welcome back for our second half of today's edition of American Indian and Alaska Native Living. I'm Dr. David DeRose. My guest, David Jones, licensed marriage and family therapist. He is also an adjunct professor at Weimar University. If you're not familiar with Weimar, probably should talk just a bit about it, David. Both you and I share that common background. I was once a teacher on that campus back, 10, 15 years ago now, and a beautiful campus. Tell us a little bit about it for those who've never been to Weimar University.
Yeah, so Weimar University is nestled there in Northern California. It's in a very beautiful setting. I can't remember, it was like something like 150 acres with the property there. Lots of places to be able to hike. It's so, but the school itself is probably the education that students are able to receive there is by far and away the most attractive part of it. Because there are lots of very competent individuals that are have really mastered their field and their study, but they're able to integrate a larger picture. So beyond just teaching, you know, the health and sciences, they're also looking at some of these larger, if you will, existential factors, how this plays into like overall health and well-being, how this plays into our spiritual health. And that's just so unique because not very many universities are able to integrate all of these different facets. You know, as human beings, like we don't just think in terms of academics. We also have lifestyle and relationships and this whole larger realm in which we live, asking questions about why we're here and what our purpose is. And this is a university that brings all those things together in a way that's pretty beautiful. So I really enjoy it.
Yeah, I really appreciated the perspective there when I was on the faculty. And I like this emphasis on very, you know, practical training. I know the students are getting out doing community service projects and things. And one of the classes I taught was a nutrition class. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't just sitting in the classroom. You know, students were going out giving lectures or doing cooking classes, working with Whole Foods in a school. So, so folks that are looking for that kind of practical training, like you said, integrative training, Weimar University, a really great place. Thank you, David, for making a difference there. But we want to come back to try to make a difference for everyone. We got folks who are tuning in today who feel like the academic training is long behind them, but they're still dealing with some really intense issues. You were telling us a story before we stepped away about a woman who grew up in a very difficult environment. Her mother was abusive to a degree that you graciously spared us, but you're now, presumably, or at some point, you were dealing with her in a counseling relationship. Am I understanding that correctly?
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
So how did you help her?
Yeah. So for her at this point, she was trying to figure out and trying to make sense out of like, why would my parent treat me this way? Why would she? Mm. And, you know, children usually come to conclusions where they tend to blame themselves. It can be what's referred to as egocentric. That's not being egotistical or proud. It just means that they see the world as happening because of them. And mm-hmm. so they see themselves as the center of responsibility. And so they came to some conclusions that maybe I am worthless. Maybe I am someone who just makes things tough. And of course, if that's the case, then what you do is you try to fix yourself by being extra responsible, mm-hmm. extra nice, try to keep mom and dad happy, try to keep everyone else around you happy. And they found themselves continuing to do that, taking on this broad narrative of like, I'm responsible for keeping everyone around me happy. And they couldn't figure out why it kept driving them. And it really took them into some places where it was overwhelming them. So when we came in, we started to kind of process through some of these traumas. And there was two things that we did. One is I tried to help her understand her own story, like that she didn't need to hold on to these responsibilities. It wasn't her job to fix her mom or to make her mom a nice person or to make everybody else around her nicer, better people. That was not exclusive her responsibility. She can have influence, but it could not ultimately just rest completely on her. The second thing that we really started to emphasize is all this time that you've been taking those responsibilities, what's happened is that you've probably been neglecting some of your own needs. So like when I see parentified children, a lot of times they will take care of their parents by trying to be the good boy or girl, take care of things if mom or dad are like passed out because they're using excessive amounts of alcohol. And then they never actually get to experience their own development as a child.
Mm.
And so one of the things that we talked about is like, okay, how do we start to nurture these parts of yourself that have been neglected for so long? Because that story of neglect from your parent, you're not living out that same neglect for yourself now, because like now you're neglecting yourself the same way you neglect. So how do we start to bring that back in? And so she began to do that, and you could see these changes start to happen. Now, the last step in there was one where the question kept coming up of, why did my mom do this? Why did my parent treat me this way? And so this one, I don't know if every therapist takes a step, but I find this to be useful for sharing this. And so I said, okay, what do you notice about your mom's behavior? Well, one of the things that she noticed was that her mom would always find a way to insert herself into things, and she would always show up in these really cruel ways. And one of the things I asked is like, okay, but when you show up in a cruel way, this is kind of a crude way of making sure that everyone pays attention to you. Nobody ignores the person who's making lots of noise or causing lots of destruction.
Mm-hmm.
And when we boiled this down, the message that came clear was what your mom seems to be communicating to this world is you can hate me just as long as you don't ignore me.
Hmm.
It was very clear that that was exactly what her mother was trying to do, was trying to make sure that people paid attention to her. Now, she took it in a very vengeful and spiteful way and like demanded the attention of those around her. But as soon as I said that, I can see tears that started to show up in her eyes because she recognized her mom as this terribly lonely person who was just mad at the world for neglecting her. And so she passed it down to her as well. And so she made sure that that train stopped with her. She made sure her kids didn't feel overly responsible for taking care of her emotions and her feelings. She made it very clear that she was there for them and not the other way around, and tried to foster their development and foster them as well. So it was really lots of details in there that it'd be hard to articulate at this moment, but it definitely broke that cycle of neglecting and started instead putting in its place, taking care of oneself and being able to make sure that you nurture and take care of the next generation. So she was able to break that.
So I know, David, just from dealing with lots of folks throughout Indian country and beyond, that a lot of folks are resonating with what you're sharing. I hear them. If they were talking, I mean, I can imagine, you know, saying, yeah, I need to be more aware. Maybe I need to find someone like David to work with me, because sure, we can share the concepts, but it sounds like most people, if they're really dealing with some big stuff, they probably do need some professional help. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. Especially if the person's not able to emotionally regulate, that becomes a really big one. Now, some people have been able to kind of walk themselves through doing some self-help, but if you have a PTSD diagnosis, it's extremely difficult to work that on your own. I wouldn't say it's quite like trying to do heart surgery on yourself, but it's pretty tough.
Okay. Let's kind of broaden the topic then, because PTSD, of course, post-traumatic stress disorder, that can stem from generational trauma, but it can come to anyone regardless of what their background was. And we want to talk about this aspect of emotional regulation that you just mentioned. So help us understand how that fits into this whole narrative.
Yes. So it's okay if I just give maybe a really brief description of what kind of happens in the brain and body with post-traumatic stress?
Perfect.
Okay. So the way I try to explain this to people is just imagine like you are driving your car and then a car like, you know, stops right in front of you now and you have to like hit the brakes and your car starts screeching. There's several things that are going to happen in that moment. One of them is that your heart rate is going to start to accelerate. Your palms are going to start to sweat. Your pupils sometimes can dilate depending on what's going on in that exact moment. The other thing that will happen is that your ears will dampen down to where you're only really able to hear lower frequencies. So if you're listening to the radio or listening to this podcast, hopefully this isn't happening to you right now, because anyway, what will happen is you'll actually start to tune out the noise behind you. It's almost like the person talking to you, their words won't make any sense. You kind of have that Charlie Brown, wah, 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 because your brain is now completely focused in on survival. Now, if you, let's say in this case, you stop and like you hear the screech, you smell the smoke of the burning tires and all sort of stuff, but then you narrowly miss and you're okay. Like, so you just dodged a bullet. Okay. And so what will happen is everything will kind of come back down to normal. You start to hear your friend again. The radio will start to sound again. Hopefully you can say something nice to the driver in front of you. But like all that stuff will start to tone back down to the baseline. Trauma is like being up there, but not coming back down. So people with PTSD tend to have a very hard time tracking in conversations. They feel really socially disconnected. They are easily kind of startled. Almost all of those little physiological signatures that you're experiencing in a moment of heightened arousal, they stay there. So this is why it's called post-traumatic stress disorder, because after the fact, they can't recover.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not the disorder is not the event, but the reaction to the event.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think Gabor Mate had a really good quote on this one of like, trauma is not what happens to you, but what happens in you. And so this is why PTSD is a very difficult diagnosis to treat, because it essentially kind of rewires how your nervous system is behaving, and it does not let you come back down from that baseline. Now, where emotion regulation becomes really important is because if PTSD is staying too high up on that 1 to 10 scale that I had mentioned a little bit earlier, let's say you're staying up at a 7, then to recover from PTSD, what has to happen is you have to be able to drop back down to a baseline. It sounds really simple, but there are lots of things that actually allow you to do this. And people who have gained the ability to regulate their emotions, to help their nervous system to feel calm and regulated and safe, tend to not be as adversely impacted by the trauma itself. Now, there's a talking cure part of this, like, you know, where you actually process through the stories, like what we've been talking about here so far. But trauma happens in the body, and it happens in just like what you would refer to as like the limbic systems in the brain, like so the emotional parts of the brain, not so much the thinking parts of the brain, but the emotional systems in the brain. And so a lot of what needs to happen is there needs to be a reconnecting with those higher operations of the brain, because all of those are shut off, like in the car accident scenario I was giving there. You're not going to be doing hard math when you're trying to stop your car. But we need to be able to drop things back down to baseline so you can reconnect with those higher parts of the brain, so the personality and social connection can all come back online. And so that becomes a really important tool in actually helping people to heal from trauma. It's why traditional talk therapy for PTSD all by itself doesn't tend to work that well. Because the person isn't logically unaware that they shouldn't be running from cherry blossom, if we want to reference back to our old thing. And most people who have been in car accidents and are afraid to drive, they know that every occasion in the car is not going to be a car accident, but their body doesn't believe them.
So how do we get the body to learn to behave differently? If we just look at the car accident example, is it actually when you're working with someone, you're actually having them tell themselves messages? Is it, how do you deal with that?
Yeah. So there's a rule that I use, and it's going to sound tangential, but it really is connected here. So for parents, there's a two-step rule that I found to be really useful. And it's something that a gentleman named Dan Siegel has written about. And it's the idea that you connect before you correct. Right. So if a child's having a tantrum, if you just try to rush into correction, sometimes you get more tantrum behavior. And if I try to tell somebody who's experiencing trauma, like, hey, just calm down, you're fine, everything's cool, it usually just kind of ramps things up or can make things worse, because they already know that, but it's their body that's... So what I want to do first is I want to connect with what's happening with them, both on that visceral level, and then I want to try to then correct or calm them down. So it's connection before correction. All right. So that connecting term becomes really important, because there is a way to help that person experience that. And one of the ways that I do this is I help them connect with their bodies first. And so when somebody's reliving an experience, like having a flashback, if you look at brain scans, you can actually see that there's certain parts of the brain that go quiet. For those of you who like to get into some of the technical information, it's your dorsolateral prefrontal cortex. But this part of your brain tends to keep track of time and helps to integrate the past and the present together. It goes offline when somebody's experiencing a traumatic memory. Because when somebody has a traumatic memory, they're not remembering, they're reliving. Those are very different.
Yeah, I mean, this is fascinating stuff, and I know there's some really powerful practical keys that you're going to give us in our final segment. We do have to pause just briefly in the dialogue with David Jones, adjunct professor at Weimar University, licensed marriage and family therapist. I'm Dr. David DeRose. We've got a final segment with David coming up. You don't want to miss it. Stay tuned.
Today's broadcast has been pre-recorded. However, if you have questions about today's show or would like further information, please call 1-800-775-HOPE. That's 1-800-775-4673. We'll be right back after this.
If a natural disaster comes knocking, how prepared is your family? You can't just close the door on earthquakes, floods, or hurricanes and hope they go away. That's why it's important to make a plan now. Ready.gov/plan has the tools and tips you need to prepare your family for an emergency. So if disaster shows up at your doorstep, you'll be ready. Visit ready.gov/plan and make a plan today. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
I'm just texting him back.
I'm just posting a story.
I'm just changing the song.
I'm just...
No. When it comes to distracted driving, just don't. Sending a text takes your eyes off the road for just 5 seconds, but in that time, your car can travel the length of an entire football field. Any distracted driving just isn't worth it.
Visit StopTextsStopWrecks.org. A message brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, Project Yellow Light, and the Ad Council.
What is a number story?
My number story started with fear and a lack of support, and it has led me to be there for others.
A number story begins in our childhood with ACEs, adverse childhood experiences.
My number story begins with the separation from my father and the emotional abandonment from my mother, and leads to me being a role model to not only myself, but those around me by becoming the person that wasn't there for me.
ACEs are so common, 2/3 of us have one.
My number story begins with drug abuse and homelessness, and leads to realizing that I can live life by my own standards.
A study found the more ACEs, the more likely we may experience a host of serious health effects, physical and mental, but that doesn't need to be the case. Your ACE number is simply an entry point to your own story. Where it leads is up to you.
My number story begins with years of emotional abuse and leads to peace, clarity, and security in my self-worth.
Take control of where your number story leads at numberstory.org.
You're listening to Dr. David DeRose on American Indian and Alaskan Native Living. Your comments and questions are welcome. Call now at 1-800-775-HOPE. That's 1-800-775-4673. Here again is Dr. DeRose.
Welcome back to our final segment of today's edition of American Indian and Alaska Native Living. Dr. David DeRose with David Jones. David has been trying to help us get insights that can help us rewire our own brains. David, we definitely want to jump back into the scenario you were mentioning, but before we do, I know there's a lot of folks that say, wow, this guy's got a wealth of information. I'd love to connect with him. I know you got a busy practice. You're not looking for more clients. You and I had spoken offline about that. But if someone does want to reach out to you, maybe learn a little bit more from your perspective about Weimar University or learn about what you do, how do they track you down?
Yeah, it's wisetherapyllc.com. That is my webpage. There's a contact form that you can fill out if you have questions for me or like to get in contact with me about either the work that I do at the university or any of what I do in my own practice and have questions about the topic. You can definitely contact me through the form on that page. So wisetherapyllc.com.
So WISE, just W-I-S-E?
Yes, W-I-S-E, like WISE or wisdom, like W-I-S-E, therapyllc.com.
I got it. Okay, so let's go back now to this scenario. We're talking about people, traumatic events. You gave the scenario of a person stopping just short of an accident, stress hormones, everything ramped up, and used that as an illustration of how some people with PTSD, often they stay at that high level of anxiety, and basically they're not able to necessarily reason things out when they're in that emotional or that brain state. So help us to understand then how you reach them or how a person can get help when they're in that mode.
Yes. One of the strategies I use is helping people to get grounded. So I want to first connect with them with where they're at, help them to notice what's kind of happening in their bodies, to kind of turn around this as interoception, but help them to recognize what's going on in their bodies, with their heart rates. But then I also try to bring their attention to present things like, how do your feet kind of feel on the ground? How does your bottom feel in the chair? Like, what do you notice about what's happening here? Can you pay attention? Can you look at what's happening between the two of us right now? So just things to bring them into the immediate present moment. The second thing that I'll do too is that if we just really need to regulate is we use breathing strategies. And so, you know, if somebody wants to use one, I use 6-7-8. So they breathe in for a count of 6, they hold for a count of 7, and they exhale for a count of 8. When you do that, it actually overall slows down your heart rate, because when you are exhaling slowly, your vagus nerve helps to slow down your heart rate. And if you make your out breath longer than your in breath, then you are going to overall start to calm your nervous system. One other really cool trick, if you're in like a really stressed state, is you can use cold water. I've had some of my clients do this when they feel distressed, is if you actually just fill like a bowl with some ice water and you put your face in there, it will actually calm you down really quickly. You have what's referred to as your trigeminal nerve, and it runs through your face, and you have what's called a mammalian dive reflex. You don't have to remember all this stuff, but just think about if you were running away from something and then you jumped into some ice cold water and you feel that like immediate shock. One of the things that has to happen though is that your heart rate has to slow down. Your blood vessels are going to have to respond to this to make sure that you conserve oxygen. And so what actually happens as soon as your face touches cold water, it tells your body to signal and calm down. So those are just some quick tips on how the body regulates itself. But then there's a second piece here too, because the person with trauma is reliving, not remembering. One of the big transitions is how do you get them to exit the reliving cycle and get back to a place where they can actually just remember the event without constantly reliving it. This one's a little bit trickier, but it is something that can happen. So I had a patient I was working with, and he was living in the Middle East before coming here. And one of the things that happened was there was some huge family conflict, and this person came to their home and like tried to burn it down while people were inside. Now, they escaped. So just advisory notes there, like they did escape. But they afterwards blamed themselves for not acting as courageously as they could have. Mm-hmm. And so what we did is we started to process that memory. And of course, predictably, they started to relive it when they were telling this story. And what I asked them to do is I said, I just want you to imagine what it is that in that moment you were feeling and what it is that you were really needing. And they said, it was hard for them to talk about this because guys usually don't acknowledge that they need things. But it's like, at that moment, I just wanted to know that I did the best I could and that everything was going to be okay. I said, I just want you to imagine for a minute, like, that if someone could have said that to you, that it's going to be okay. You did the best you could, and that's okay. And I watched them, and you can see them almost kind of like, almost like somebody jerked them awake, and then suddenly just had like tears coming down their eyes. You can almost see them like physically start to have a reaction. But what was happening is they were actually physically letting go of the trauma. They finally told themselves that you don't have to keep repeating the story. You don't have to keep trying to reimagine this moment and think of all the things you've done wrong. You did the best you could, and it's okay. You can let go. And when they let go of it, it's like it let go of them. And the change between that session and the next session out of them was night and day. It was just absolutely incredible. But we had to connect first with where they were at. And then we were able to redirect. So one of the things that I believe is, I think of it as a God-given ability, is that even though we can't change the past, we can fix the past and the present. And it's a very strange thing that we're able to do. And everybody's probably done this to some small degree where like you have this memory that really bothers you and you go back and you think, well, what would I have said and what could I have said? And if you actually let yourself go through that process, a lot of times you can actually let go of it. You'll see animals do this. They had this video of this polar bear that got tranquilized while it was running through the snow. And they tranquilized it and then they did whatever studies they were trying to do with it. And then they injected it with something so it can come back online and be conscious again. Now, when it got tranquilized, it was running because it saw this weird thing, a helicopter. It probably looks like an oversized dragonfly chasing it. I was like, what in the world is going on here? And they get zapped with poison or whatever that is. And so anyway, the polar bear, when it comes back, it's actually conscious. And the narrator just explained to you that it's conscious. And you can actually see it starting to breathe in. And then it starts to like look like it's running in place because it's laying on its side and it's kind of galloping. But the narrator says this polar bear is not asleep. What it's doing is it's picking up where it left off in its story. And the last thing they remember is that it got shot and then and didn't make it. But it's like this time they're going to play the story through where they get away. And that's exactly what you see the polar bear doing. It goes through this whole thing where it runs and then it does this and then it shakes itself off and then gets up and then just has a normal life. It has no ulcers, no PTSD or anything like that because it actually finished the story for itself. And this is exactly what this patient I was dealing with experienced there too, is they walk back into that story where everything seemed to get stuck and they seemed to have done everything wrong. They put themselves back into the scenario, but this time they gave themselves and they said, look, you did the best you could. It's okay. It's done. And they let go. And so it's really incredible how the brain and body can actually get online and do and go through these kinds of motions. But, you know, these things are easier in a professional setting. It's very hard to walk ourselves through this because at some point in this process, you can get pretty dysregulated. You know, when somebody's reliving something, it's not pleasant. And it's helpful when you have a voice on the outside that can say like, hey, let's try this and let's move here and let's do that.
So as we're winding up, is there anything someone can do for themselves? Someone's tuned in today to say, hey, listen, things aren't as bad, you know, so bad that I need to call David or some other therapist, but you know, this thing is bothering me. You know, this person did something to me or I went through this experience. Is there anything, you know, for someone who's functioning pretty well, something that they can do on a mental level, cognitive level that would help them?
Yes. So when we run into these cases, I think one of the things you can do is take some techniques from what's referred to as cognitive behavioral therapy. And so this is CBT. But one of the things that you do is you start to keep a log of the things that you're telling yourself. Right. So people may be telling themselves all kinds of messages that might be really destructive. In fact, if you type in cognitive distortions, if you just do an online search of that, you'll find that there's about 10 to 12 cognitive distortions. One of the things I would say is to just start paying attention to what it is you're telling yourself about these situations, what this person has done to you, et cetera, and really start to examine those beliefs. Because what you'll find is that when you see these beliefs, that they're probably not entirely accurate. And so similar to what happens with trauma, the same thing happens with cognitive distortions is we have beliefs that are very, very black or white, very extreme. And in fact, if you look at the kind of thinking that's going on, this is the kind of thinking that's common when you're in a threat situation. Like you notice that most of your AB options come from fight flight. That's an AB option. And you will find that in areas where you're stuck, you're probably stuck in some sort of A-B kind of thinking where everybody hates me or nobody loves me or this person is completely good or completely bad. Those are all very kind of extreme things. And the truth of it is that there's a lot more flexibility than this. And so if they can go through and challenge some of those beliefs, that tends to be a much more helpful way of dealing with it. So even if I refer back to the patient that I referred to before with the mother that was really abusive, for a long time, they were just saying, you know, she did it because she's evil. But then when we actually looked at it, it's like, well, is that the best explanation? And when we actually looked at it, it's like, no, she did this because she's afraid of being alone. Like, she's terrified of the idea of being ignored. And you can know that this is a real human instinct. People would do almost anything to make sure that they're not ignored or alone in the world, even things that are not particularly healthy for them.
David, you have such a wealth of information. I wish we had a much longer show, but our time has basically slipped away from us. One more time, if someone wants to connect with you and access some of that wisdom or maybe even set up an appointment with you, how do they do that?
Yeah, so the contact information for you,